Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
British anti-terrorism police arrested four men in Birmingham, England, early this morning. News reports say that one of the men is suspected of being involved in last week's failed attacks on the London transit system. You'll remember those attacks seemed to be modeled after the July 7th bombings, which resulted in the deaths of 52 passengers. We spoke earlier today with Here Now's Michael Goldfarb, who is in London, and we asked him first to tell us about this morning's arrests.
Well, early this morning at around 4:30 a.m., police in Britain arrested Yasin Hassan Omar, who's alleged to be one of the four bombers whose explosions failed to detonate last week. He was photographed running away from the Warren Street Underground station. They arrested him in the Hay Mills section of Birmingham. Now, Birmingham is the second largest city in Britain. It's located about 100 miles north of London. The arrest took place with the suspect being subdued with a taser gun. A suspicious package was found with him. The entire neighborhood, about 100 families, were evacuated.
And the three other men that the anti-terrorism police have arrested in Birmingham, how were they arrested? I mean, you mentioned that Yasin Hassan Omar was pinned down by a taser gun. How were the other three taken?
The other three were found at what police are calling a safe house in the Alum Rock section of Birmingham, some miles away.
Where are Yasin Hassan Omar and these other three men now, and who are the other three men?
Well, the other three men have not been identified, and what's most important is to note that Yasin Omar has been taken to Paddington Green Station back in London. Now, Paddington Green, over the decades, has been the secure police interrogation facility where all terrorist suspects have been taken for questioning. So this is a very, very significant arrest. The other three are in police custody still in the Midlands, and the police are declining to say whether they were actually involved in planning last week's abortive bombing raids.
Do we know any more about them and their background, what nationalities they are?
No. Not on the three men in the Midlands. What we know about Yasin Hassan Omar is that he is of Somali extraction. It's interesting to note that that first deadly attack on the London Underground back on July 7th was carried out primarily by British-born men of South Asian origin. In this case, it would seem that this attack was primarily carried out by recent arrivals who may well have been seeking asylum, and in fact, at least one of them was granted political asylum and leave to stay indefinitely in this country, and they've only been here for about 10 or 15 years.
Michael Goldfarb, speaking to us from London, what are some other developments, because we understand there are more today?
Yes, well, this is very, very interesting, Robin. This arrest follows 2 days of intensive searching at an apartment complex in North London. Now, this apartment complex is a public housing project, and the apartment being searched was shared by Yasin Hassan Omar and Mukhtar Saeed Ibrahim. They apparently made their bombs there. The police thoroughly searched this apartment, interviewed everyone in the vicinity, and then late yesterday they found an abandoned Volkswagen Golf on the North Circular Road, which is the first of several highways built around London over the last 60 years as Brits got used to driving cars, created traffic havoc. Working from the clues gathered at the Volkswagen and in the apartment, they tracked this man to Birmingham and made the arrest.
Was it his car?
We don't know.
Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from London as the situation there continues to percolate. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
The debate over emergency birth control is emerging as a new front in America's culture wars. The latest volley came in Massachusetts this week when Governor Mitt Romney vetoed a bill that would expand access to the morning after pill, sometimes called Plan B. The governor says he opposes the medication because he believes it not only prevents pregnancies, it can abort them. We'll have more on how this issue may be helping to propel the governor onto the national stage. He's now considered a contender for the Republican nomination for president in 2008. But first, a look at how this issue is stirring debate in Congress and in state legislatures across the country. Marcia Clement has written extensively about the morning after pill for the Congressional Quarterly Researcher, and she joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Marcia, the morning after pill, which is supposed to be taken several hours after sex, is supposed to interfere with the process of getting pregnant in several ways. Can you explain how it does interfere with that process?
It does interfere with eggs being released by the woman. Stops it, in fact.
And everyone agrees on that?
Everyone agrees on that. It may interfere sometimes with sperm fertilizing an egg. General agreement about that. In the past, it has been thought that it occasionally interfered with a fertilized egg implanting in the uterus. But there's current science that suggests pretty strongly that it does not prevent implantation.
Now, when Governor Romney and others who are like-minded say that it causes abortion, are they referring to that third process?
They are referring to the third process. They would say that human life is formed when the egg and sperm get together, so that if that human life is prevented from implanting, then that is abortion on their definition.
And the pill may or may not do that.
The pill certainly does that seldom, and it may do it never.
But even if the pill were to prevent a fertilized egg's implantation in the uterine wall, it doesn't terminate an established pregnancy. I mean, it's not the equivalent of a surgical abortion.
No, it absolutely will not terminate an established pregnancy. It is not the equivalent of either a surgical or a chemical abortion, such as is done by an abortion pill, RU486.
Well, this issue has also been debated on the national stage, with the FDA postponing a decision on whether to allow the morning after pill to be sold over the counter. Tell us about that decision.
In 2003, there was a request made by the manufacturer to sell the pill over-the-counter. It sold over-the-counter in several other countries. The FDA, under new rules, had a pretty short time frame to make a decision. It passed that time frame. An FDA advisory council recommended, by an overwhelming majority, 23-4, to sell it over-the-counter. The FDA then continued, after the advisory council ruled, continued to delay its decision, but finally came down on the side of the tiny majority of the committee and decided that it could not be sold over the counter because of concerns that they said they had about young women, notably girls under the age of 16, being able to use it. The company that makes Plan B then submitted an application to sell it over the counter to people 16 and older, and with a prescription only to those under 16. That decision is now currently scheduled, we understand, for September.
How has Congress become involved in the issue?
Congress has stayed out of it to some extent. There are several bills, including two major ones in the Senate, that would require pharmacies, but not pharmacists, to give people access to it as quickly as they can. On Monday of this week, the House Small Business Committee, however, had a hearing on this issue, and they were concerned about the pharmacy issue because in rural areas in particular, there are certainly many pharmacies that really only have one pharmacist. So in that case, requiring the store to supply it, if it only has one pharmacist who morally objects to it, would raise a problem.
Well, the issue is definitely being discussed in different states. And here in Massachusetts, even though Mitt Romney, a governor, vetoed the morning after bill, it passed in the state legislature. It's got a veto-proof margin. It's considered likely to be enacted into law. But broadly, what's happening in other states? What are the two main issues about the morning after pill that are being debated?
The two debates are whether hospital emergency rooms should be required to give the medication to rape victims in particular, or if they object to giving the medication, be required to refer rape victims or give them information about it, and whether pharmacists should be allowed to dispense it without a prescription under certain protocols. There are seven states currently that do allow pharmacists to dispense, and there are quite a number of others who have that under serious consideration. There are a handful of states, mostly in the Northeast, that are requiring emergency rooms dispense it.
And what are some of the political arguments for and against? I mean, we heard that Mitt Romney is against the morning after pill because he feels that it can cause abortions. But oddly enough, we see emergency room contraception can reduce the risk of unwanted pregnancies by about 75%, which could then prevent abortions.
The political argument really appears to be pretty much entirely a religious one, that because this pill may possibly inhibit implantation of a fertilized egg, it is abortion. The fact that it prevents another kind of abortion doesn't really signify much with folks who believe that preventing the implantation is itself abortion.
But what about the question, and a Boston Globe reader frames it in a letter to the editor today, responding to Mitt Romney's comments, saying, you know, sort of, what's next? Isn't this morning after emergency contraception the equivalent of a woman taking two birth control pills when she's skipped? So is there a sense that this is the beginning of another debate?
Well, there are a handful of pharmacists around the country who, in fact, do not fill birth control prescriptions. So it's not clear that the debate will go that far because Americans overwhelmingly support birth control, but it's a possibility, certainly.
And how does the public feel about this issue? Give us some numbers.
The polling is usually 60-70% at least in favor of requiring people to give you your prescription for this, and that's pretty much across the board, I think.
Marcia Clement reports on the morning after pill and the other political ramifications of contraception for the Congressional Quarterly Researcher. Marcia, thanks.
Thank you.
And now a closer look at Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. As we said, this week he vetoed a bill that would expand the availability of the morning after pill, even though he supported access to emergency contraception when he ran for office in 2002, and the state legislature is likely to override his veto today. Well, there's widespread speculation that Romney is using the issue to court conservative voters as he tests the waters for a potential presidential run in 2008. What does that say about Romney? What does it say about the Republican Party today? Joining us now, Sridhar Papu, who wrote an extensive profile of the governor for the Atlantic Monthly. Welcome.
It's a pleasure being here.
Well, as you know, in an opinion piece in the Boston Globe on Tuesday, Mitt Romney says he is now against the morning after pill, in part because he believes that it could cause abortions. But as we just heard, the large body of evidence shows it does not cause abortions. Why do you think he is taking up this issue now?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. Romney himself will say that he's taking up the issue because it was presented before him, because of the legislation. And he said the same thing about gay marriage as well. And his stance has always been, or since the election, that he wouldn't tinker with any of Massachusetts' abortion laws, and that there would be a status quo. And I think that his argument would be that he's maintaining that status quo.
I guess I wonder, too, with the preponderance of evidence saying that the pill does not cause abortions, it prevents pregnancies, why do you think he would make this stand, draw this line in the sand?
Well, I think, I mean, clearly there are national stakes at play here. He and his people have always said that his positions haven't changed over the years. But if you look at what he said sort of outside of the state and in recent actions that he's taken, clearly he's sort of playing to the more right-wing elements of the Republican Party, who he's trying to press for a presidential race.
That's Sridhar Papu, who's writer for the Atlantic Monthly. When we come back, we'll hear more about the Mormon governor from Massachusetts, who's being talked about as a possible frontrunner for the Republicans, and the things that he's saying that are bringing him into the limelight. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. We've been talking about the politics of the morning after pill and how this issue has brought Massachusetts governor and possible Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney into the limelight after he vetoed morning after legislation this week. We've been talking to Sridhar Papu, who wrote an extensive profile of the governor for the Atlantic Monthly. Sridhar, Mitt Romney has been criticized for saying one thing in Massachusetts and another thing outside of the state. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, I mean, in Massachusetts, he tends to talk a lot about logistics. He's a numbers guy. He's a businessman. When things come up, he likes talking about data. But if you look at his speeches in South Carolina, in Utah, in Michigan, what he talks about are things like gay marriage, which he is opposed to, and which he's fought vehemently against in Massachusetts. He has talked about America being a nation that believes in God. He's spoken out against abortion rights and embryonic stem cells for research.
Well, then there was that flap when Romney's top political advisor, Mike Murphy, told the National Review that Romney was a pro-life Mormon, faking it as a pro-choice friendly. Now, Murphy says he was taking out of context, but some say that rather than flip-flopping on issues like emergency contraception, Romney has been revealed as a real right-leaning conservative. Which do you think is true?
The issue is actually very complicated. It's hard to tell from his language. I mean, he's very careful with his words, something they learned from his father, who had his own president aspirations dashed in 1968 because of comments that he said about the Vietnam War. If you sit down and you talk with Mitt Romney, what you find is someone who tends to lean right and maintains his positions have evolved over time. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to look back at certain races, 1994, his Senate campaign against Ted Kennedy, his 2002 run for the governorship of Massachusetts, he comes off much, much, much more moderate. And he, in fact, says that he's a different kind of Republican. Massachusetts is used to Republican governors, but as in New York, they're not, we like to say here in New York, they're not real Republicans. They're social moderates who've always leaned towards the center. I think Romney is the first true Republican, red state Republican, to actually govern the state.
So what is thought of Mitt Romney, that he is a moderate in the mold of a Nelson Rockefeller and his own father? But now we hear this language again, saying that emergency contraception could be used for abortions. It's sounding as if he's trying to appeal to the hardcore right of the Republican Party. Is that a slippery slope?
It's a very slippery slope, especially in a state like Massachusetts, where his poll numbers have dropped precipitously. An argument can be made that the less popular that Mitt Romney becomes in Massachusetts, the more popular he becomes to the real power of the southern Republican states. And, you know, he's getting hammered left and right. It seems like he can't do anything right. Following the recent London subway explosions, he decided to ride the T, and, you know, the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald were all over him because it's not like New York, where the mayor actually will take the subway to work. So you have Mitt Romney at a station and looking totally out of place. And in fact, he did not know how much the ride cost. He didn't know what station he was at. Yeah. And spent the whole day being heckled.
On the other hand, Mitt Romney is incredibly attractive in many ways. He's personable. He's charismatic. He's smart. He's known nationally for rescuing the Utah Olympics, known because his dad was a 3-time Michigan governor and presidential candidate. But as we said, like his dad, he was known as a moderate, now getting attention for his statements against gay marriage and emergency contraception. So what does his possible candidacy say about the Republican Party right now, do you think?
I think it really sort of reflects a party in flux, and that it's going to have to try and find itself after George W. Bush. One of the more interesting things that came up in my piece was talking to a Bush advisor who had worked on the campaign, and saying that that Romney will have to prove himself to the southern states, not much like George H.W. Bush had to prove himself to the southern states. Currently, we have a president who is lock, stack, and barrel in line with the core thinking of the people who now hold the power in this way of the party. But we're going into an election in 08 where we have a vice president who's not going to run, and we have a few governors and a few senators who are all sort of jockeying for position, but none of whom possess the kind of qualities or the kind of reach that George W. Bush has.
And when there's another issue, the core of the Republican Party, the hardcore, is held right now by the Christian right.
Yeah.
Mitt Romney is a Mormon. Is that going to be an issue?
Well, in my piece, I was talking to Ted Kennedy, and he said, you know, you didn't ask me the question whether Mormonism would be an issue in his national campaign. And I sort of said, well, you know, I meant to. And he said, well, no, that issue died with my brother Jack. And if you were to talk to people on the record, they'll say, well, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, speaking to at least one person on who worked for the Bush campaign, he said, well, this is an issue that he's going to have to deal with because it's a religion that most Americans know very little about. And there are misconceptions about it.
And how does the Christian right feel about Mormonism?
You know, I think in southern circles, it's viewed with a great deal of skepticism. And he will have to sort of, at some point, either make the point the case that his faith will not affect his decision making, or will have to sort of defend his faith, which seems a burdensome task.
And he's been very reticent to talk about his faith to people like you here in Massachusetts.
Yes.
Multiply you by thousands if he makes a presidential run. You know, thousands of reporters who will have questions.
Yes, I mean, and during my piece, I felt very reluctant asking about it. But you know, for someone that seems to have presidential aspirations, who will be replacing someone who talks openly about his faith, these are questions that he's going to have to answer, and he's going to have to answer them thoroughly. I think his people hope that they can sort of get it out of the way, should there be a presidential race, that they can get out of the way.
Sridhar Papu's profile of Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney appears in the current issue of Atlantic Monthly. Sridhar, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And later in the program, another man whose faith is drawing national attention as Mitt Romney's might, as Jack Kennedy's once did. Supreme Court nominee John Roberts is a practicing Catholic, and there are reports that Roberts might recuse himself on issues such as abortion. Stay with us. That and more ahead here and now. Newly released documents show that as a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department, now Supreme Court nominee John Roberts played a key behind-the-scenes role giving conservative legal advice to his superiors. But the thousands of documents released yesterday by the White House don't reveal what Senate Democrats really want to know. What are Roberts' personal views on abortion? As Roberts continues today to pay courtesy calls to senators who will vote on his nomination, we thought we'd check in. Boston Globe reporter Charlie Savage joins us first on the line from Washington. And Charlie, Roberts' personal voice, if not his opinions, comes through in these documents. What do they tell you about him? He was then a 26-year-old legal hotshot.
Yes, well, Roberts is a very interesting guy in this thing. This is early 80s, and there was a lot of aggressive Reagan Revolution types that were throwing bombs, had an in-your-face style about what they believed and why they believed it. Roberts had a very different tactic. Over and over, we see him advising colleagues to conceal the sharp edges of what they really think in terms of conservative ideological views behind an innocuous cloak. He wants to avoid a backlash from moderates, not stir up controversy. For example, we have him prepping Sandra Day O'Connor for her confirmation testimony, and he's telling her, don't answer questions directly, just demonstrate that you're familiar with the legal precedents involved in a given issue, and then move on.
And his supporters would, at the time, I'm sure, would say he did a good job.
She made it to the court, and since his own paper trail is so sparse about what he really thinks on most views, it seems that he's been following his own advice for the last 25 years.
Well, you write that in these memos, he seems at the time to support Republican legislation that would have stripped federal courts of jurisdiction over abortion. That's supporting Republican legislation, again, being a representative, but does that tell us his personal view?
Very hard to get a concise answer of what he thinks about abortion from this. That's a proxy issue. It's a couple levels removed from how he would vote today on Roe v. Wade. I would say the issue that is most clear out of this, at least we have one opinion that makes sense, is on affirmative action. There's a very interesting memo in which he's taking apart, step by step, a 50-page report that had been written by a Carter-era U.S. Civil Rights Commission chairman calling for more affirmative action in society. In a rare display of candor, Roberts dismantles this. He says it's circular logic, it would just lead to quotas, and the guy thinks that affirmative action programs have failed and the recruits have dropped out of school in a police academy because it was sabotaged. Roberts says, no, it's just because they were underqualified in the first place. Although he says, don't say that in public, let's just write an innocuous response to this and get rid of it.
We have one more insight. He counseled the Attorney General on how to handle the delicate question of continued funding for the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. Briefly, what did he advise?
Well, he advised not telling Coretta Scott King that she shouldn't have gotten the grant in the first place. It was only her political connections to a Carter-era grant administrator that got her the $250,000, and that the money was squandered, which was what they really think. He said, just tell her the money's not available anymore, but we sure share your goals and even express pleasure that we were able to help, we being the government. So once again, he's being very diplomatic in public, shielding the sharp edges of what he really thinks.
So, Charlie, how are these letters resonating?
Well, people are still mulling them over. I think it was a lot. It was 15,000 pages of documents. I'm sure there's more that we missed on our first rifling through them yesterday. It's a lot of information to process, but it's hitting at the same time that there's still an ongoing fight over another set of documents which haven't come out yet, which the Bush administration says they're not going to let out. Those are from his 3 or 4 years in the Solicitor General's office in the George H.W. Bush administration, because he was dealing there with more directly on these questions that everyone wants to know, you know, abortion cases, and it would be fascinating to see what the internal dialogue was of what position the administration should take. The administration says they can't let him out because then future lawyers will not be candid about what they think, because they think it might screw them up down the road if they're ever nominated for something. And so we're still going to have a continuing fight over what gets out and what does not get out.
Stay on that story. Charlie Savage, Washington reporter for the Boston Globe. Charlie, thanks.
My pleasure.
Now, a brief moment with Alan Wolfe. He's director of the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. Professor, you've been listening in. Do you think Americans should know more about Roberts' personal views on matters of abortion?
Well, in all matters, including abortion. His matters about economic and social justice, his matters about affirmative action. We're talking about appointing someone to the Supreme Court for perhaps 40 years. I think the American people have a right to know what he believes.
Well, law professor Jonathan Turley caused quite a stir this week when he wrote in the Los Angeles Times that Senate Democrat Dick Durbin asked Roberts directly about how his Catholic faith would affect his rulings. Roberts, according to Turley, paused for a long time, then answered he'd have to recuse himself on issues such as abortion and the death penalty. Now, Durbin says Turley's take is inaccurate, but Jonathan Turley says he read his column to Durbin's people and they signed off on it. So, question to you, Alan Wolfe, what happens if Roberts recuses himself because he's a practicing Catholic?
Well, he won't. And he can't. One of the wonderful things about the Catholic Church is that it has a position on just about everything, from stem cells to the war on poverty. To recuse yourself when the Catholic Church takes a position is not to be a judge. So don't take that seriously. I actually didn't even understand why Robert said that until I just heard Charlie Savage, who I think it explained it very, very well, that the whole Robert strategy is simply denial. And it's the whole Bush strategy. Well, you know, Robin, it's a very funny thing. I mean, we live in the most ideological times imaginable. Yeah, when it comes to appointing someone for a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, we're all told that we should shut our eyes, we should cover our ears, we shouldn't even hold our noses and pretend that there's no such thing as ideology. It's unbelievable.
Well, do you think there is such a thing as judicial restraint? In other words, not letting one's personal views or faith affect rulings. I mean, it's one thing to have them and say you have them, but it's another to say you won't let them affect the rulings. Do you think that's possible?
Oh, yeah. Judge Frankfurter, Justice Felix Frankfurter, was a great believer in judicial restraint, and he wrote eloquent opinions in which it was very clear. He said, I believe X, but the law commands me to do Y. We have every right to know what people think. It doesn't mean that their opinions will inevitably follow. I mean, take this whole religion business. We're always told that religion is so important because it shapes people's outlook on the world. It gives them a sense of morality. Well, Justice Roberts has religion. To know more about his view of the world, we should know more about religion and his religion. The idea that somehow to ask him about his Catholic faith manifests anti-Catholicism, which is a charge that's being leveled against Catholic senators like Dick Durbin. You know, it's really quite absurd.
Well, you mentioned that Dick Durbin is a Catholic, as are some other prominent
Democrats.
Right,
Patrick Leahy and, and Teddy Kennedy. They're all on the Judiciary Committee.
So you know, the accusations of Catholic bashing against them seem a little hollow.
Unless you believe that Catholics hate, you know, self-hating Catholics. I'm Jewish. We talk about self-hating Jews. Maybe it's the same thing with Catholics. But no, this has nothing to do with Catholic bashing. These are perfectly appropriate questions. By the way, I personally am heartened by the fact that Roberts is Catholic. There are three Catholics on the Supreme Court now. Sandra Day O'Connor, who recently resigned, was an Episcopalian. The Supreme Court we currently have is the first in our history in which a majority of members are not Protestants. Roberts would add a fourth Catholic voice. There are two Jews on the court. Four Catholics and two Jews equals six. That means two-thirds of the nine justices will not be Protestant. In a majority Protestant country, that's amazing.
Alan Wolf, director of the Boisy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. We will call on you again, Alan, because the issue of religion is sure to be raised again as John Roberts goes through the nomination process.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you. And still to come, Street Languages Theater will hear the poetry that makes up this language. You're listening to Here and Now. Question, what if Ann Landers were an economist? What if you asked her about dating and she helped you work out your problem using the tools of Adam Smith? Tim Harford does just that in the pages of the Financial Times. He writes the Dear Economist column for that paper. He's also the author of the upcoming book, The Undercover Economist. Tim, welcome.
Hi.
Let's right away give people an example of what you do because it's actually pretty hilarious. I'm going to read a letter that you recently received, and you tell me, sum up how you answered, okay? A woman writes, Dear Economist, I am a virgin, but shortly to be married. My fiancé says that he took a virginity pledge as a teenager, and so there's no need to test for sexually transmitted diseases. She asks, should I accept this? Your response?
Well, to get the answer here, we need to go straight to the most recent winners of the Nobel Prize for Economics, Finn Kidland and Edward Prescott. And what they said is that governments, like her fiancé, often take pledges, and governments often break them. Mm-hmm. So the government might take a pledge, for example, not to print more money and increase in inflation, but everybody knows not to believe them. Whenever you come to the time of trial, you may decide that the promise that you made is no longer worth keeping. So the question that my correspondent has to ask herself is, has this man really lived up to his virginity pledge, and how can he prove it? And what I advise her is that if she wants proof, the easy way to do that is for him to take the test. If he lived up to his virginity pledge, then there's no harm in taking the test. And if he didn't live up to his pledge, then he'll be unwilling. And the very fact that he doesn't want to take the test should tell her all she needs to know.
That question, whether or not he's taken a test, you say is a non-verifiable contract under asymmetric information. Give us some other examples of when you've quoted, you know, Nobel laureates or other economists in answering a question about dating or relationships.
Well, just this weekend, I had to refer to the Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz. The question was this. You remember the very popular dating handbook, The Rules. Mm-hmm. And the rules say, should I turn down a date if it's offered at short notice? Should I only accept a date if I'm given 4 days' notice? Let me try this, Robin. Ask me out on a date. Ask me out for dinner tonight.
Would you like to go out to dinner tonight?
I'm sorry, I'm too busy. You see, it's so easy to say. It's a meaningless signal. But there is actually some solid economics behind it. And that economics came from Joseph Stiglitz, who won the Nobel Prize in 2001. What I'm trying to do is actually, I'm not trying to give you a signal that I'm busy. I'm trying to get a signal from you. And the signal is, anybody who isn't capable of giving me 3 days' notice for a date is either inconsiderate or disorganized or probably dating somebody else. And any of these people, I don't want to date. So it turns out it's sound advice. Thanks very much, Joe Stiglitz.
And his is the screening theory.
Yes, screening theory from the 1970s. But, you know, it's bang up to date.
And you also, in that same response, point to game theorists.
Ah, yes. Well, game theory started with a man called John von Neumann, who was a mathematician. He teamed up with an economist to develop a theory of how people should respond to each other when they were interacting in a strategic way. Mm-hmm. Von Neumann was supposed to be the smartest guy in the world. He once put Albert Einstein on a train going the wrong way. But his theory's actually been used to analyze anything from nuclear war to poker. But I use it to analyze things like dating or interactions between parents and their children.
Most unusual problem that you've been confronted with by a reader?
Well, somebody did write to me saying that they were considering suicide. Mm. And what would I advise? And I said that I advised against it. And the reason is as follows. Obviously, being a rational person, they will have thought of killing themselves by carrying out a cost-benefit analysis, considering all the costs of continuing to be alive and miserable and all the benefits of being alive and miserable. But that's actually a mistaken cost-benefit analysis. When you're alive, you always have options. You never know when something might turn around, when you might get lucky, you might find a partner, a new dog, a new job, any of the things that are depressing you. And if you kill yourself, you just can't take advantage of that.
Well, you're almost advising him to view himself as a stock market. with ups and downs.
Absolutely, with ups and downs, like a stock. But at the same time, when you think about the advice, it's pretty sensible. It's like, don't kill yourself, things might get better.
Tim Harford writes the Dear Economist columns. For more, go to our website. You can read them there, here-now.org. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. The sounds of the stage show Slanguage, part poetry, part hip-hop, part decades of slang heard on the streets of New York. It was created by the performance group Universes, artists originally out of the South Bronx, and it's currently playing at the Boston Center for the Arts. Joining us in the studio, company members Stephen Sapp. Welcome, Stephen.
How you doing?
I'm just fine. And Ninja?
Thank you.
The one named Ninja, two members of a larger company. We'll find out more about the company in a second. But Stephen, can you describe? I just tried to describe Slanguage. Yeah. How would you describe it?
Well, Slanguage is kind of like a train ride through New York City, and the different stops that you make, sort of going through the city, and how we learn language. How on the street you can take language and you flip it around and you do all these different things with it. So it's like a whole show of that, of how we learn language, how we flip it from nursery rhymes to traditional poetry, to, you know, rap, you know, hip hop, the whole thing. It's a whole gamut.
Oh, you're not kidding. I mean, in one segment, I caught JJ from Good Times, Jack Kerouac, and Humpty Dumpty.
Yeah, there
they
you
were
go.
All sort of in one slice. Where did the idea come from?
Really, it was just really kind of sitting, being around each other, the ensemble together, just writing and going to open mics and performing. And we met Joe Bonney, who's a director.
Yeah, the wife of Eric
Bogosian, yes. Mm-hmm. And she would invite us to her office, and we would literally sit there and just bring her writing. And over the course of 2 years, we discovered, like, oh, my God, we have a show.
Right. Ninja, how would you describe yourself? I mean, what is your background, and what kind of language understanding do you bring? Do you speak another language?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was born and raised in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. I'm New Yorker.
I love that. New Yorker and Puerto Rican, right?
Puerto Rican, New Yorker. Mm-hmm. I was raised, my first language was Spanish, and then as I went on into elementary school, I started learning English. I learned from my older sisters. You know, they'd come home and watch cartoons, and I learned English from cartoons. Then I got into school, and I was in there with all these mixed races, and that's kind of where I you know, learned slang, which, you know, I guess slang is the form of communication between races. You know, it's kind of the middle ground where we can all understand each other. Mm. Before I knew how to express myself in understandable English, that's all I spoke was slang. Right. Until I got into high school is where I started understanding, well, in order to get a job, you have to be able to speak like your boss. Right. And then, you know, I went on to college, and then I was like, well, in order to pass your class, you've got to be able to speak like your professor and the other students if you want to compete.
That's Ninja, a performer in Slanguage, as is Stephen Sapp. And Stephen, slang is a big part of the show, but so is poetry. Let's listen to a section where you define what a poet is.
You are not a poet if you don't know who Leroy Jones was really meant to be. You are not a poet if you don't know about Mikey and Willie and Reggie, Kamanyaka, Mom, Steve Cannon, Dale Sawingins.
I guess I don't know who Mikey is. Who are some of these people
Mikey
that you cite?
Mikey is Mikey Pinheiro, which is one of the founders of the New Rican Poets Cafe in New York. Mm-hmm. We're from sort of that old school poetry. We feel like you need to know your history if you're going to claim yourself to be a poet. So from Kerouac to Buckley to Nas, you know, who's, you know, an MC, that whole gamut of writers you need to know,
right,
and understand how it works, because it's all language, it's all pentameter. And we know all that stuff, so we're able to take it and sort of turn it inside out.
And as you say, be able to take someone else's poems and riff on them and love them,
mm-hmm,
and shed a tear over them.
Mm-hmm.
Ninja, newer member of the company.
Hi.
Are you studying at night? Are you like, I got to catch up. I have to read Kerouac.
Well, at first I did. I had a lot of catching up to do. It took me about 6 months to really understand the show that I had been performing for 6 months there. Mm. And now I'm trying to learn the rhythm of the poetry in terms of writing. Mm. I'm trying to learn how to get my emotions and my thoughts and my ideas out on paper and have the same appeal that this show has. Mm. We're talking about funk here. We're talking about making the show pop. Because we could be out there delivering poetry and it'll be a monotone sound, and only those with the deepest intellect will follow us. Mm-hmm. But then we want everybody from the neighborhood to follow us, even those who haven't been educated.
Mm-hmm. And then they might go pick up a Leroy Jones or
right,
a Jack Kerouac.
Right, that's the first step, to get them to relate to it.
Yeah. The whole piece takes place on the New York subway. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a little of the section where on the subway, even the mundane act of getting a seat becomes an event. This is another member of the cast, Mildred Ruiz, who is your wife.
Yes, she
Mildred
is.
Ruiz Sapp, one of the female voices. Let's listen.
Don't mess with me. Don't mess with me, no. I had a trying day. I'll get on my knees and pray to hit the lottery so I can tell my boss to kiss my ass day. We lost the account, the check bounced, the copier jammed, broke a nail on the mouse. My stockings are running, my feet hurt, and I'm using my panties to hold up my skirt. So I need this seat.
42nd Street Times Square.
Stephen Sapp of Slanguage, what's the importance of trains?
Well, if you really sit on a train and if you really pay attention to who's sitting on the train, it's one big giant melting pot, yeah. Especially when it goes through one borough to the next. So it's all these different types of people on the train talking in different languages and different sounds and different rhythms.
Too close to each other sometimes?
Yeah, yes. which is great.
Each other.
Yeah. So if you really sit there and you listen to the rhythm of that, it's beautiful. It's really amazing, mm-hmm. How different people speak and talk and walk. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we do. We just listen.
Can you just give me a few seconds of just a sense of the show when you are speaking in just a gumbo mm-hmm. of different kinds of sounds and words?
Okay. And it goes a little something like this. This is another autobiography from at-risk agitators assaulting and assembling articulation and alliteration. From Mala to Amos and Andy, and there ain't no artistic affirmative action here. Just an autopsy on those asphalt archives. Brick by 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 brick. Big head bow-legged b-boy brothers build in front of boogie down Bronx bodegas. Brang about bambadas, blessings and the beats about beat to the barber while Brooklyn bohemians break bread at breakfast, rebirthing boilerplate blues.
Whew, and that's just A to B.
Yes.
And it goes all the way through.
It goes all the way to C.
We want to leave you with some of the music from the program. You'll be joined by Mildred Ruiz, who's going to be singing as well, as a ninja tells the story of an imprisoned,
right.
Someone in prison.
Right, someone who's been in there for the long haul and is probably going to be there for a while. This is called Breeze. I started this poem on my first day on the inside to remind me of the me that I'm supposed to be. 'Cause I've gone through an evolution, a transformation of the highest degree. I have walked through the valley of the shadow of death. I have seen demons, and I am one.
I remember. One last question for you, Ninja. Do you dream words? Are words constantly in your head?
I definitely do. See lots of words in my everyday. Walking down the street, I'll see something that'll strike me so deeply emotionally that I will have to go back, and I'll already know what I'm going to say when I'm going to sit down and write it, what I saw. I will already have been thinking about it in the subway. How can I put this into the exact words that I want to use to make this flow in a way that's going to make sense and sound interesting? It's all about the words. We play with words. They're definitely our favorite toy.
Ninja and Stephen Sapp, they're members of the group Universes. They're performing in the play Slanguage. The show is being produced here in Boston by Company One. It runs through August 13th at the Boston Center for the Arts, but it's going to other venues in the fall. So for more information or to hear an extended version of Breeze, go to our website, here-now.org.
Do your bit like a man and understand that no matter how much time you got, you can't waste time counting the time you lost. 'Cause time only gives us so much time to tell time in. And nobody knows what that number is. And right now, I'm just another number, waiting for that first breeze to work its way over the electrical fences.
bleeding from the curls of razor wire.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
The mules who carry contraband on the low, and the diaper snipers who prey on kids for kicks. From cell block to cell block, from those who hide their tears, from the other mother brothers on the tears, the cell gangsters who
sell funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.